This was 1955. Another year glides on its way to eclipse. Perhaps not a year that will shine from the pages of history for the changes it has seen within its span. And yet for us, one which was rich with the prophets of enthusiasm. A year peopled with more than its quota of famous names. A year whose reverses have been no more significant than its victories. A year filled more with hopes than achievements. A year whose checkered schedules have yielded the framework of this program. And so, let the months become minutes while we recapture voices and events from the context of 365 days in the life of a nation. We offer you brevities of 1955, recalling words and deeds which went into the making of our year in New Zealand. These were some of the things you heard, read, talked about. This was 1955. The year started well. In common with most folk, we enjoy being praised, and one of our first visitors did just this. Monsieur Roger Duvel, Secretary of State for French Territories Overseas.
I had the impression of arriving in a little bit of Europe, transported in the midst of the Pacific. What struck me particularly in New Zealand was a very high standard of living, which is obvious and the signs of an advanced civilization.
From the United Kingdom came General Sir Gerald Templer, Chief of the Imperial General Staff.
This is the first time I've ever been to your lovely country, though I very much hope it won't be the last. I feel personally that I've a lot of friendly links with New Zealand. In the British Army, I'm colonel of my own old regiment, the Royal Irish Fusiliers. Several New Zealanders, some of whom I number among my oldest and best friends, served as distinguished regular officers in my regiment. We in the regiment, and they in New Zealand, have never lost touch with each other, and I hope some of the younger generation of those families will join us in the future and keep up the old tradition.
And from the United States of America came her most famous explorer, Rear Admiral Richard E. Byrd. Before leaving for his venture into the ice of Antarctica, he unveiled a commemorative plaque in memory of the United States Marines who sailed from this country to battle in the Pacific. Tawara, Saipan, Guadalcanal, and places whose names are forever fresh in our memories. Before he left our country, he recorded this message.
It's great to see these old friends. I have a great many of them here. And in the family of nations, I think of New Zealand as a brother. And that's the way many people in the States view this wonderful country.
From Germany, we had a visit from a trade delegation who came primarily to meet government officials. But their visit was not entirely concerned with trade talks, as we heard from their leader, Dr. Jonkers, of the German Ministry of Foreign Affairs.
It would be almost useless to restrain ourselves only with governmental talks, that means practically with talks from office to office, that we could do at home too, or by written. What we want to do is to get acquainted with the country, to get acquainted with the people we are dealing with, to see them, to see what the country looks like. And I think that's much more important, because, as a matter of fact, trade means connection between people and not between books or houses and things like that. And from this point of view, we are very pleased to be here in New Zealand, and particularly I myself, because it's the very first time I'm here, and in fact it's the first time that I'm here on the Southern Hemisphere, and I like to stay here, and I hope we shall have quite an opportunity to get acquainted with the Northern Ireland as well as with the Southern one.
And then from Scotland, we had a memorable visit from Dame Flora MacLeod of MacLeod, who stayed with us some months, meeting her fellow clansmen.
I've come from 12,000 miles away. I've found nothing but friendship. I came away from my own people. I have found a family. I came away from my own home, and I have lived in the homes of my family. I have shared their lives, and I feel that I know them in a way that no person who had lived in a more formal, distant way could ever have got to know them. So I thank you, my clan family, for this really beautiful welcome.
We met two of the men from Wales, the Reverend Ivor Powell, official evangelist of the Baptist Union of New Zealand. Now, he's a man of many hobbies, especially photography. And during an interview, he told us this story of an experience in South Africa whilst photographing lions.
I shall always remember one day we'd seen lions 17 times. You see, there was a drought on, and they'd all come to the Sabi River to drink. And as I said, we'd seen lions. We'd been seeing lions all day. And suddenly we turned a corner, and there was a black man walking along. And my wife gasped. She said, "Hey, look, a man." So I stopped the car alongside of him, and my wife, she leaned out and she said, "Hey, boy, boy, lions, lions, lots of them all over the blessed place. Boy, aren't you scared they'll eat you up?" He laughed and he said, "No, ma'am, lions no eat me up. I work for the government."
And then the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, Lord Brookeborough, is yet another name in our 1955 visitors' book. He and Lady Brookeborough thoroughly enjoyed their tour of New Zealand, and coming from a pastoral country, were more than interested in our agricultural system. Before leaving, Lord Brookeborough had a message to pass on to the Maori people.
"I would like to take the opportunity of sending a word of greeting to the Maori people, whose fame is spread throughout the empire, and whose history as the first settlers of New Zealand has caught the imagination of all those who have studied it. I rejoice to meet you as I travel through New Zealand, and to see the full part taken by you in all the varied walks of life. May I send you a personal message of greeting and good wishes on behalf of the people of Ulster."
And there we have a very brief cross-section of some of the year's official visitors. By now, they've all gone home. But we'll remember their visit with pleasure. Sir John Kotalawala, Prime Minister of Ceylon, General Kariapa, High Commissioner for India, the Earl of Hume, Secretary of State for Commonwealth Relations in the United Kingdom. But there were others coming to New Zealand with a different object: the start of fresh and carve new lives. From troubled Europe, many hundreds have found peace and tranquility in new surroundings. Yes, it'll be a memorable year for some who took the oath of allegiance at special ceremonies in the North and South Islands.
"Will you repeat after me? Would you place your right hand on the Bible? And will you repeat after me? Thank you. I,
Vladas Kredelaitis,
swear by Almighty God,
swear by my Almighty God,
that I will be faithful,
that I will be faithful,
and bear true allegiance,
and bear true allegiance,
to Her Majesty,
to Her Majesty,
Queen Elizabeth II,
Queen Elizabeth II,
her heirs and successors,
her heirs and successors,
according to law,
according to law."
From the more serious side of the year's activities, let's bring back memories now of some of those who have entertained us during the year. For instance,
"When love comes in and takes you for a spin, oh la la la, c'est magnifique. When every night your loved one holds you tight, oh la la la, c'est magnifique."
And that, of course, was the voice of Jean Sablon, internationally known French cabaret singer who toured our country in the earlier months of the year. He sung practically everywhere, but his tour of New Zealand brought him to these parts for the very first time.
But when, once more, she whispers, je t'adore, c'est magnifique.
And then, representing the more serious side of the theatre, were Dame Sybil Thorndyke and Sir Lewis Casson, with their extensive repertoire and message of goodwill. Dame Sybil recently celebrated her 50th anniversary as an actress, and during that half century has seen, naturally, many changes in the theatre.
It was larger size than it is now. People were on a bigger scale somehow. I don't know where all those people have gone to now. Most of them dead, I think. I'm one of the few left of that old generation.
Tell us about some of the people who did fill the stage in those days. Ellen Terry.
Yes, I saw Ellen Terry in her last years. She was a very great actress. A greater personality than anything else. A great person. And her sister, of course, Mary Ellen Terry, was a beautiful actress. And then there were such a lot of them. And I remember the American actresses, too, such big American actresses, Margaret Anglin. And they were large-scale people. And on the comedy side, people like Winifred Emery and Cyril Maude's wife. And they were big-scale. We've got big-scale people now. I mean, for example, two people that are very, very different, but both very big-scale, Gladys Cooper and Dame Edith Evans. They're both large-scale players and beautiful, both of them in their separate way. Edith Evans is a great actress.
You just finished.
Oh, yes, she's my great friends, yes. We just finished doing a long run together of 2.5 years. And it says a lot for us both that we didn't spit at each other by the end.
Not a single sight. Did you know Mrs. Patrick Campbell?
Yes, I did indeed. Now, there was a tremendous actress. She was ruined so often by her own personality. She was too big for lots of the people that had to produce her. She was a great actress, though. I saw her play Hedda Gabler when she was fat and old, and she wiped all the young women off the stage. Oh, she was great. But, you know, in England now, they won't stand people who look too old for the parts. That's where it was different. People like Sarah Bernhardt, Duse, all could play parts that weren't their own age because people would accept the convention. They won't now. They've been too much film-fed where they want to have everything. If a young girl is a young girl, well, she's not. They don't want her to be 40.
And if you're an actress, would give up playing Juliet after...
Which is nonsense, because the best Juliet I've ever seen was 42.
Who was there?
And that was Julia Marlowe, the American actress. It was the greatest Juliet I've ever seen. She was rather large and fat, and I shall never forget it. Tremendous.
In complete contrast to Dame Sybil Thorndyke's more serious approach to the theatre, we had in New Zealand in 1955 the fabulous concert comedian Anna Russell.
We are the Great 400. If you want to know who we are, we put on airs because our forefathers came over with the Mayflower. And it's very, very snappy if your mammy or your pappy is descended from the Mayflower. We're in the social register. All lower class types we shun. To keep our niche, we must stay very rich, because we'll be thrown out when we've none. And it's very, very funny when you've lots and lots of money to be horrible to those with none. Be horrible to those with none.
And from Anna Russell, we turn to another musician of the unusual significance who came to us last year. Well, up to 6 months ago, the mouth organ to me, and very probably to you too, was just another noise perpetrated by schoolboys. However, that was before Larry Adler came. He taught us to regard the harmonica, as he calls it, as a recognized musical instrument, and set about to prove his theory in a series of memorable concerts. We were absolutely amazed when he told us just how many serious composers had accepted the harmonica into their musical sphere and had written works for it.
Jean Berger wrote the first harmonica concerto. Dalius Milo wrote one. Arthur Benjamin has written one, which Yasha Heifetz heard, and he told me that the Benjamin is going to be the Mendelssohn concerto of the harmonica, he thought. It's a delightful work. Gordon Jacobs has just written the first chamber music work for harmonica and string trio. Cacciatorian, Benjamin Britten, and William Walton have all promised me works. And as I go around the world, the various composers, one in Indonesia, for example, says he's going to write me a work based on Indonesian folk music. And the man in Singapore is going to write one. A man in South Africa has already written one based on Zulu melodies. This is enormously interesting to me. And it seems to be interesting to the composer as well. It gives him a new color to write for. And I think they like the idea of getting away from what has by now been the stereotypes of concert music.
While he was here, Larry Adler gave us the opportunity of hearing some of these specially composed works, which he played with the National Orchestra. Well, another musical visitor of note was the American pianist Julius Katchen. He came to discuss music, but stayed to talk about sport, and in particular, table tennis.
There are a lot of musicians who are first-rate table tennis players. Yasha Heifetz, the violinist, is one of the best players in the world. And the reason for this is that table tennis is the only sport that any instrumentalist can practice without it injuring his hands in any way, without there being any danger to it. Tennis, for instance, is bad for the wrist. Golf is bad for the elbow. All of the non-contact sports have something that are a nuisance for a performer. But table tennis, on the contrary, uses in many ways our abilities of coordination. And for instance, the quick wrist is very good for a backhand flick.
But why the interest in sport? Do you find you have to keep fit?
No, I just enjoy it. I enjoy the competition of it. I enjoy the action. It's getting away from the mental strain and the emotional strain that you have in your in the artistic work, and it's a healthy outlet, which I enjoy. I can go back once I've spent a few hours at it. I can go back to my own work with much greater concentration.
And from Julius Katchen, we turn to. Yes, it's Ted Heath, who in company with his famous orchestra, Kathy Lloyd, Dennis Lotus and Bobby Britton, brought to jazz fans in New Zealand the very best of modern music. Ted Heath came to us at the peak of his career, one of the foremost dance band leaders in Great Britain today. But, as he told us in the course of an interview, he wasn't always on top.
I've known it the hard way. I've known every side of the business. I've played in symphony orchestras, film orchestras, dance bands, you know, concerts, played on radio, command performances, played outside the Savoy Hotel, London, in the gutter, and played inside the Savoy Hotel. So that's something you can't buy.
You know? No, you cannot. Can I ask you about bands in Britain today? What is the trend for big bands or smaller combinations?
Big bands. So the small ones are falling by the wayside.
Yes.
The people in England today expect a lot for their money. They expect a big band with good orchestrations, a good presentation. And there's a tremendous boom. We do extremely well all the time. And there are a lot of others besides us that are doing well.
Yes, yes.
The youngsters do like their music loud and brash these days.
Music lover of the more serious turn of mind, the year was an important one in that it saw the launching of the first New Zealand professional opera company, who, during the year, presented a short season of three operas, The Medium, The Telephone by Minotti, and Susanna's Secret by Wolf Ferrari. The inspiration behind this venture has been Donald Munro.
I formed a company last year and called it the New Zealand Opera Group after having toured the North Island for the Auckland Regional Council of Adult Education with an opera called Last Over Fadrona. The success of this venture was such as to encourage me in the belief that here in New Zealand we could support an opera company with a repertoire of short operas. My belief was more or less upheld. The success last year was so great that I called a public meeting to discuss ways and means of forming a New Zealand opera company on a permanent basis. And the outcome of that meeting is that we now have a New Zealand opera company backed by a New Zealand Opera Society in much the same way as the New Zealand Players Foundation supports the New Zealand Players Theatrical Company.
From Donald Munro and the New Zealand Professional Opera Company, it's not a very wide gap to the National Orchestra. Their year has been a colourful and varied one, with works ranging from George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, played at a Promenade concert early in the year, to performances of the Mighty Ninth Symphony of Beethoven and Walton's oratorio Belshazzar's Feast. This last work was performed by the Christchurch Harmonic Society with the National Orchestra and baritone soloist Ninian Walden. First of all in Christchurch on September the 20th, and then again in Wellington on October the 8th. Belshazzar's Feast is really a gigantic work, calling for almost everything imaginable from the orchestra. In a broadcast shortly before the Wellington performance, the conductor, James Robertson, told us some of the secrets of the score.
On opening this mammoth tome, one is confronted with a frightening list of the instrumental forces which are required. The woodwind comprises two flutes and a piccolo, two oboes, three clarinets, of which one has to switch periodically to the high, squealing E-flat clarinet and another to the bass, an alto saxophone, two bassoons, and a double bassoon. The brass in the orchestra is normal, but the composer asks for two extra brass bands, each consisting of three trumpets, three trombones, and a tuba. These are placed on either side of the choir, well away from the main orchestra, and when the music seems as if it could not possibly be any louder, they add their 14 brazen voices to make it so. In the percussion section, we are asked for timpani, side drum, tenor drum, bass drum, triangle, tambourine, castanet, cymbals, gong, xylophone, glockenspiel, woodblock, slapsticks, and anvil. The sound picture is completed by the usual complement of strings, two harps, a grand piano, and, in case there still isn't enough noise, the grand organ.
Apart from performances of such mighty works as Belshazzar's Feast, musically speaking, the year was a fertile one. We were visited by such established overseas artists as our own Colin Horsley, violinist Max Rostel, the Pascal Quartet, the Irish tenor Patrick O'Hagan, the Italian tenor Luigi Infantino, the Hohner Symphony Accordion Orchestra, and the Trapp Family Singers, to mention just a few. And on the home ground, our brass band has had a successful year too. This year, the annual contest was held in Auckland, the 75th of its kind. The champion band was the St Kilda Band of Dunedin, who were awarded 144 points out of a possible 150. They headed Dunedin's other band, the previous champions, Kaikorai, by only 1 point. The principal adjudicator, Eric Ball of England, said the winning band gave a most moving performance. It had depth of tone and sincerity. Now, here's part of their winning test piece, Eric Ball's own arrangement of Negro Spirituals. Thank you. On the 25th of April, 1955, was celebrated the 40th anniversary of the landing on Gallipoli by the Imperial, Australian, New Zealand, and French troops assisted by the Royal Navy. A three-day national reunion was held in Wellington, attended by almost 1,300 veterans. We took our microphone to the reunion dinner in the town hall and spoke to some of the men who had come so far for this momentous event.
What is your name?
John Ellen.
From?
I belong to Tasmania. I'm listed in Tasmania, but at the present time I live in a little place called Petone, what they commonly known as the village.
Well, have you had the opportunity of meeting up with any of your old friends?
Yes, I have met several tonight, and I've met Mr. Perry and several others.
And what do you think of tonight's turnout?
Well, it's been one of the most memorable nights of my life.
Well, that's very nice to hear. What unit were you with?
I was with the 15th Battalion.
Yes. And tell me, you look very young, if I may say
so. I am. I could say that I'm most likely the youngest man that was assembled here tonight, that I enlisted at the age of 16 and I spent my 17th birthday on Gallipoli.
Now it's my pleasure to introduce you to the oldest member of the Gallipoli campaign here tonight. And he is the only surviving padre. It's my pleasure to introduce you to the Reverend H.L. Blamire.
Well, listeners, it's just my pleasure to tell you that we've had wonderful weather here in Wellington, and the organization on the part of the Gallipoli Veterans Association and all their committees and workers has been really wonderful. Our men have paraded in a style that does them credit. The outstanding feature is perhaps the services at the cenotaph and the great reunion. But no words could convey our thanks to the mayor and city for all that they have done, and the Right Honourable the Prime Minister and Members of Parliament for their gracious words and reception. It is our pleasure to meet also officers of the Grecian Army who are visiting us at the present time, and the men have enjoyed immensely the opportunities for renewing acquaintance, while, of course, there are sad memories of those we left behind. I feel that I am simply here representing the large number in New Zealand who would like to have been here but could not make it. Thank you.
And so we leave the veterans of Gallipoli with their memories and turn from the army of yesterday to the navy of today. Well, many of you will remember, as I've got cause to remember, the naval manoeuvres in Cook Strait of the Royal New Zealand cruiser Black Prince and the frigate Hawea. Yes, it was a pretty gusty day when a jackstay exercise was carried out between the two ships, and I was one of the first to travel from Hawea across that frightening gulf of water to Black Prince. My foot in an iron stirrup, a stout rope round my waist, and a microphone clutched in one hand. Radar interference, strong winds and sea spray didn't help to make the best of recordings.
Well, I'm about to transship now from Hawea to the cruiser Black Prince in mid-ocean. Black Prince, looking very big and very formidable, has maneuvered under our port side and is, well, I should say, some 100 feet away, about 100 feet away. Both ships are maintaining a constant speed. They're sailing into the wind and into the sea. Wind today, you probably hear, is very strong indeed, coming from the north, and I think, well, at rough estimate, somewhere about 50 miles an hour. There's a fairly heavy sea too, and the sky is blue, the sun is shining down on us. Now, a few moments ago, a line was fired across. You possibly couldn't hear the crack of the rifle, which fires a small charge carrying the line over to Hawea. Now, at this moment I speak to you, the ropes are being attached. The thinner line is being pulled aboard. Five senior officers this morning are going as well to Lankrin, so I shan't be tired on my own. And now, the ropes have been put in place. I can see On approaching, as I look across the deck bridge, I can see a team of sailors who will be there to haul us across. And I sincerely hope that their haul is strong. I must confess that the journey across the deck bridge looks to me a most hazardous undertaking. Well, I've been put into a life jacket. I've had a life jacket put over my head. At the moment, I'm having a rope buckled around my waist. My foot is resting in a large iron stirrup. And I'm holding on like grip death to the rope which is above me.
Well, from this point on, it was quite impossible for me to do any recording at all for the next few seconds, as I was suspended in midair, gyrating like a top, buffeted by the wind, as I was rapidly hauled across that frightening gulf of water to the rails of Black Prince.
A shot pull up, and I'm being helped out over the rails of Black Prince, and never has a solid thinking felt quite so welcome with these findings at this particular moment. My life jacket is being taken off. My waist is now freed from that very, very welcome rope. And back goes the syrup for the next stout heart to come from Howea to join us now on Black Prince.
Another service occasion we attended was the official farewell to the New Zealand Special Air Service Squadron before they left for Malaya. The ceremony took place on the steps of Parliament House, and the Prime Minister, Mr. Holland, had this to say.
This is a very important occasion, which, as I was about to say, carries me back to the occasion when I attended the last conference in London, at which New Zealand was asked if it would be able to make a contribution to what is called the Strategic Reserve of the Commonwealth Forces. And today we find the result of the decision to accede to that request that we should provide a well-trained and competent force of men. This small company of men, comparatively small, and I shall give a number or a moment or two, has been specially trained for a specialized task which is entirely new to New Zealand servicemen. And today we are able to say that the training of these men, and as they stand before me, I can count something like 30 or 31 members of the Maori race, of whom we are so proud being members of this force. And so they have gathered together outside the Parliament buildings of their country to enable me, on behalf of those associated with me this morning, to bid them goodbye and to wish them every good fortune.
...1955 has also been a notable year in the history of the New Zealand Railways. It's just 2 months ago that the Rimutaka Tunnel was opened, forging a new link between the Wairarapa and Wellington. I was on the first passenger train to go through the tunnel after the Prime Minister, Mr. Holland, declared it open.
I'm speaking to you now from the first passenger train to pass through the newly opened Rimutaka Tunnel, the 11th longest tunnel in the world, and certainly the longest in the British Commonwealth. The new glistening red 1500 horsepower diesel pulls us rapidly through the 5.5 miles of gleaming white concrete, shining now in the light of over a quarter of a thousand electric bulbs. And as we move swiftly and silently, I can't help but think just a little sadly now of number 199, a shining black Fell engine which was on the siding at the northern portal, manned by her crew, who waved goodbye to us as we passed them. A salute from a 77-year-old veteran who gives now pride of place to this new diesel engine of today. 12 carriages and over 600 people. And here, in this comfortable train,
now nearly midway through the tunnel, it's rather difficult to realize that a tributary of the Hutt River flows above the floor of its bed, nearly 700 feet above the ceiling of this tunnel.
And from the completion of one great engineering triumph, let's turn to the beginnings of another, the Auckland Harbour Bridge to span the Waitemata Harbour. At the present date, a casual observer could see nothing of the appearance of a bridge. But operations have been going ahead for some time, as we were told by Mr. W. Cartnew, chief agent for the builders.
Our work to date has included the construction of a labor camp in Point Erin Park, offices, workshops, and stores at West Haven Reclamation, temporary wharves and jetties in St. Mary's Harbour and Waitemata Harbour, and the construction and assembly of heavy items of plant which will be used throughout the contract.
Now I'm in the workshops. I think it's the carpenter's shop. Is that right, Mr. Cassidy?
That's right. That's the carpenter's shop. You wouldn't know.
Where are you from, Mr. Cassidy?
Middlesbrough, England.
Middlesbrough. A lot of men on this job from Middlesbrough. And how long have you been here?
Been here 10 weeks now.
10 weeks. And have you been in New Zealand before?
No, haven't been in New Zealand. Just Australia.
Australia. You spent some time in Australia, have you?
Yes, Sydney.
Yeah. And what about jobs of this kind? Anything to do with bridging before, have you been on?
Well, I've been on the Dorman's Bridge Department for a certain period and Cleveland Bridge Department for a certain period.
I see. And in these workshops here, just what are you constructing now, Mr. Cassidy?
Well, it all is connected with the installation of the job at present.
...6,200 tons of steel, 40,000 cubic yards of concrete. Such is the magnitude of materials to be used in the construction of a project which came to fruition in 1954, and we await with interest and speculation the progress that 1956 will bring. This year, too, we've seen the start of production at Kawerau. We've seen the £1 million search for oil and the high hopes and expectations of uranium on the West Coast. We said au revoir to Sir Edmund Hillary, who is even now with Dr. Fuchs in the Antarctic. In the world of sport, we saw the MCC cricket team. From China came their soccer team, the Indian hockey team, the Australian rugby team, and French rugby league. We had a visit from the British junior women's golf team, and, of course, New Zealand horses brought home the laurels from the Melbourne Cup. And so we reached the close of the year, the final summation of the months that have gone before. The curtain has descended on the play, and the characters disappear into the dusty backstage of the past. And so, with a flamboyant gesture, we consign the year to history, for there it will soon belong. To each of you, a share of the brightness and excitement that 1956 will bring. But, in passing, we leave you with this memory of the little monuments that we've left along the way in the old year. For this was 1955.